A colleague who was leading the Bible studies at the annual Christchurch Clergy Conference had an amusing opening line. "I do not have a problem with queues," meaning I rarely ever speak to groups or lead services where there are big numbers. We live in a time where that's the way it is for many clergy, but crowds are very much in evidence in this morning's gospel reading, so much so that Jesus must get in a boat where he sits down to teach the large gathering that's lined up along the lake shore. Now he's got the audience he needs in his mission to reach out and persuade the lost children of Israel. Just then he starts using his characteristic and controversial teaching method for crowds, parables. This is a huge subject in New Testament scholarship, one over which much ink has been spilt. Why use a teaching method that often darkens people's understanding as much as it enlightens it? At one level, these are stories that open up deep religious truth by earthing it in everyday experience familiar to the life experience of the audience. Usually, these stories have a surprise ending, a punchline that explodes in your face, shatters your usual worldview, and leaves you open to a new perspective on things. Creeping up on your audience in this way is probably a good idea if you're going to make startling claims about yourself. The bold statement, "I am the longed for Messiah, the Son of God, the bringer in of the kingdom of God," would probably be a bridge too far for many in the audience. Best to let people come to that conclusion themselves by inference, by picking up on the story, the clues in the story about the kingdom, by being led in stages to a truth too big to take in at one sitting. The more you think about it, the more the story does its work, like a good movie whose images stay with you that you can't get out of your mind. But often the parables leave people puzzled. Their understanding is darkened. They turn away without wanting to hear more. Opportunity has knocked and they have missed it. Their encounter with ultimate truth has occurred, and despite all their background training in the religious traditions of Israel, they can't see or understand what is right in front of their eyes. We're back to the issue that was being wrestled with last Sunday, the mystery of rejection, why some people get it and others don't, why some people are tone deaf to what they are hearing, while for others this is the royal road to a deepening discovery about what makes the world go round. Of course, for us the problem is different. We've heard the parables so often that they've lost their capacity to shock or surprise. We tune out because of our over-familiarity with them. Oh, it's the parable of the sower this morning. Here we go again. It's quite a long one. Why can't he get to the point? And we know what the parable means anyway. But do we? The end of the stick that we're inclined to grasp is the bit towards the end that was probably interpolated into the story by the early church to explain why some of its converts and congregants hadn't stayed with them. He was a flash in the pan sort of person, no wonder he didn't stick around. She was always into money, so that's why she got sidetracked. He couldn't hack it when trouble and conflict started, so that's why we don't see him anymore. But if that is all the parable of the sower is about, then it won't address or reference us with any urgency or personal challenge. It becomes a story about why other people didn't go the distance, about other people's failings, about them over there who aren't with us anymore. Well, we can just pat ourselves on the back that we are the loyal ones who are still here, so really this parable doesn't apply to us. But it does, and the operative verse, the punchline, is the one that goes, "But the seed that fell into good soil is the one who hears the word and understands it, who accordingly bears fruit and yields 100-fold, or maybe 60-fold, or 30-fold. Are we bearing fruit 100-fold, or it may be 60-fold, or 30-fold? Is our Christian walk one of deepening fecundity, ever increasing productivity, and of never failing generativity, no matter what our age or condition? Are we fruitful in the ways of the kingdom, good stewards who don't just hide our treasure in the ground, but instead shrewdly invest in it and make it grow? Or are we stuck in a rut, pretty much in the same place that we were a decade ago in terms of our Christian understanding and in our commitment to Christ and his church? The reason I'm a Christian now is not the same reason I began my Christian walk at the age of 13 when I was confirmed. If my faith understanding hadn't grown beyond what the vicar told me in those pre-Evensong confirmation lessons back in the mid-1960s at St. John's Rangiora, I would be struggling now. The reason I'm a Christian now is not the same reason when I was ordained in Peterborough Cathedral back in the late 1970s. What I said from the pulpit then as a curate makes me cringe to recall in its immaturity and shallowness. There have been several points in my several decades of ministry when I faced what I would call a crisis of revitalization. Either I went deeper, or I would face a law of diminishing returns that would challenge my ability to go on. These were occasions of having to consider the daunting question, was I ever really a Christian in terms of what I now see it involves? The scales had fallen from my eyes and action was required. My point is that our relationship with God never stands still. It is not a matter of stasis and it can't remain in a holding pattern. Either we are moving towards God or we're moving away from him. Staying in the same place is a recipe for stagnation and decline. Then we really are in danger of dropping out and becoming one of the fadeaway brigade. This is the way it is in all our key relationships. I remember when I was chaplain to King Edward Barracks, then the headquarters of the army in the South Island, one of the officers I got on with was about to retire, having done his 20 or so years in the green machine. He and his wife were about to move to Tauranga to begin a new life. "I'm going to have to work on the marriage," he said. "It's a good marriage, but I've neglected it. I preferred to go skeet shooting on the shores of Lake Ellesmere on the weekend rather than spend time with her. Now we'll be together a lot more, and we both need to be prepared for that in a positive way." This is the way I understand this morning's parable. What Jesus had to say caught each member of his audience at a different stage in their faith development. Either they were moving towards God, in which case it opened up wider vistas of what getting close to God would involve, or they were moving away from God, often without realizing it, because they were stuck in a rut and stagnating, in which case they turned away, confused or indifferent. Often what Jesus had to say awoke a slumbering no to God, as much as it awoke an enthusiastic yes to God. In closing, I am resolved then not to get caught in a numbers game, endlessly speculating about those who mooched off out of the church, but instead to turn my attention to why I am still in the church, why I am still a Christian, and what I might do to deepen my gospel walk, and thus to know the joy and human flourishing it brings, that enlargement of life that comes to those who give it a go with some persistence.